This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And just to let you know about something that will be coming up, we imagine in about 40 minutes or so, we're going to be hearing from Canada, where the long-serving Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is about to hold a press conference. There is a lot of, I think, what we can delicately call informed speculation that he is going to announce that he is stepping down. We'll hear him speak and we'll be finding out why later in the programme. We're beginning, though, with a story which you might think on first hearing might not sound that stunning. Former leader on trial over allegations of backhanders. But this is a story on another scale and perhaps with big implications right now. The former leader is Nicolas Sarkozy, one-time president of France. The alleged slush fund, well, that was for his victorious run to the Élysée Palace in 2007. And it came, so prosecutors say, from one of the world's then most ostracised dictators, the Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. And that was the sound of the Presidential Guard in Paris playing as Nicolas Sarkozy hosted Mr. Gaddafi at the Élysée in 2007 after he turned after he'd been elected president and bringing Mr. Gaddafi very firmly in from the cold. Well, the start of the trial today comes at the end of a mammoth 10-year investigation and, as we'll hear in a moment, could have a major impact on the already filthy opinion many in France have of their politics. For his part, Mr. Sarkozy says that the accusations have been concocted by Libyans in revenge for his support for the Western intervention that, in fact, in the end, brought down President Gaddafi in 2011. Christophe Ingrin is part of Nicolas Sarkozy's legal team.
He has contested this accusation and it is grotesque. We don't even know the amount of this alleged financing. Depending on who you ask, it's 5, 6, 50 million, 400 million. We don't even know what the currency is.
Well, let's get more on this now from our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield. Hugh, it is quite a convoluted story. What is it exactly that prosecutors allege Mr. Sarkozy got, and in return for what?
Well, as you heard there, I mean, the exact amount is not known. But the prosecution say that there is evidence of a deal. A deal reached, they say, by Sarkozy himself and by his team, former ministers like, or people who went on to become ministers like Brice Hortefeux and Eric Vert, well-known names in French politics, who in 2005, that is before his election, when Jacques Chirac was still president and Sarkozy was an interior minister but clearly hoping to become president, there's a deal reached when Sarkozy went to Libya. This was a time when Gaddafi was coming back onto the world stage. He'd condemned the Twin Tower attacks. He was being courted at that point, if you remember. There was a deal then under which Gaddafi said, look, I can give you money, and what you can give me is help in my rehabilitation, help on various issues that I want. Give me contracts as well, and we need investment in Libya and so on. That's the allegation, and well, we'll see. You know, the mammoth 3-month trial. What whether it stands up?
Yeah, and it's not just about Mr. Sarkozy himself, is it? I mean, there are some other senior figures on trial.
Oh, indeed. I mean, isn't all these things? I mean, you know, this is Sarkozy's fifth appearance in court over the last few years. He's getting very, very accustomed to it. He's entangled in these judicial affairs, which his enemies say are absolutely emblematic of him and the way he ran things, and which his supporters say are absolutely emblematic of a vindictive judiciary which is politicised and wants to bring him down. But it's not just him, it is his lieutenants, these politicians I named, a number of international figures, above all a man called Ziad Taqiyadine, who is well known in France as a kind of Lebanese middleman who, you know, has played a role in all sorts of shenanigans going back decades linking so often French politics and big money bags characters in Africa and in the Middle East. The original sin of all of this is the failure of French politics to finance itself, which has meant that historically these parties have had to look abroad for money. But Sarkozy says that never happened, because by the time he was running, there were systems for party funding in place. He didn't need this. And he says, as you say, at the beginning, this has all been concocted because people hate him in Libya, because he helped bring Gaddafi down.
Now, Sarkozy himself, he is currently wearing an electronic bracelet because he lost his final appeal after being convicted in a separate corruption case last month. Is there any prospect, were he to be found guilty in this, that he could actually serve time in jail?
I think not. Technically, he's actually not wearing his bracelet yet, just to sort of clarify, because that's still, they still haven't got around to organise it, but he will very soon be wearing it. So he will be a former president wearing an electronic tag in court, which, you know, is not edifying at all. Right. I think even if he's convicted in this, I think it's unlikely he'll go to jail, because simply for the reason that they do everything now to avoid white-collar criminals like this, or alleged criminals going to jail. They try to find other ways of getting them to serve their time. It doesn't mean he won't be convicted, but I very much doubt he'll go behind bars.
Understood. Hugh, thanks ever so much. Florence Fouché is Professor of Political Science at Sciences Po University in Paris. What about the implications of this case for the way French people think about their politics more generally?
Two things there. First, Sarkozy remains to an extent an important figure on the right. And since he has been forced to take a back seat, no one has been very successful in replacing him as an identified leader of the right. And his memoirs, the two volumes of his memoirs, have been very popular. So he remains an important figure on the right. And this is all the more important, as you may know, Les Républicains have not won very successfully the last legislative elections. And even though they have two ministers, there's no one who really rises to the top. So that's quite important to note. But as you were saying, indeed, this is just one more story, possibly, that can confirm that that French people have low esteem for their politicians. But it's a story again that has been has taken so many years to develop. A lot of people, unless they're on the right, do not trust Sarkozy. I don't think it's that story that is going to change very dramatically the point of view of French people, who have many more worries to have considering the instability of the government.
And that was Professor Florence Fouché. Now, you might think it would have been fairly straightforward for the South Korean police today. The person you have to arrest has a very public profile and you know where they are. But the police announced today that they could not carry out the warrant to arrest the impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol. That warrant expired just 15 minutes ago at midnight local time. Mr. Yoon is wanted over his declaration of martial law last month. He's wanted to answer questions over that. And he remains inside his presidential compound, which his security team and supporters have blockaded. Jen Moon is a freelance journalist from in South Korea's capital, Seoul, and spoke to me just before the warrant expired.
We have the president sitting in his home, and we have the police trying to make an arrest of him. But never before seen were the images that we got when the two government rivals had a standoff at his residence, trying to one make arrest, and the other Presidential Security Service trying to block this arrest. Anti-corruption investigators probing Yoon said that they in fact have failed all grounds to serve the president with this detention warrant. And with that detention warrant due to expire, they've actually issued a requested for an extension to the Seoul Western District Court. But they declined to say how long this extension would last, if granted at all. We'll have to wait and see whether that will be granted at all. If not, then the investigators will ask for another warrant, a new warrant, to detain President Yoon Suk-yeol and arrest him. And it's been proven difficult because of his many, many supporters who are camping at this moment as well, trying to protect him, as well as his presidential security service, who are very loyal to him.
Yeah, well, you talk about his presidential security service being loyal to him. But, I mean, I would have thought that they were in the pay of the state, that they are public officials. And also, I mean, there's an acting president now. So on what basis are they saying we continue to guard our president and stop him from being arrested?
So what they're saying is that they're pulling their duties to the fullest, trying to provide security to the sitting president. Of course, they have been met with lots of criticism, saying that they've only become an army for one man, Yoon Suk-yeol, but they've just swiftly brushed off that criticisms and dismissed that as saying that they are staying loyal to the president after all.
Okay.
Police, however, are weighing next steps. They say that they might deploy SWAT teams to bring in the president if they're met by the presidential security services blockade next time they go in.
And in terms of the president, or the former president, I should probably call him, Yoon Suk-yeol's own party, I mean, how is that going down with them? Are they staying loyal to him, or are they profoundly embarrassed by what's going on?
So the initial image was that they were embarrassed by all of this, as none of them were in the know of this martial law decree being declared. But right now, many of them are staying loyal to him. In fact, 44 lawmakers of his own party stood up against the impeachment protesters today at his residence, saying that they will stand by the president and that this impeachment, as it is not to go down the right road.
The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been in town today. How much of an issue do you think this is for the Americans?
Probably a lot. The Americans would like to make sure that there is no daylight between the U.S. and ROK in terms of its bilateral alliance. In fact, Antony Blinken today in Seoul said that there is no daylight and that their alliance goes far beyond one man or one institution or one government. So they'd like to make sure that the security alliance is safe vis-a-vis North Korea. North Korea fired a ballistic missile today. Together with his counterpart, South Korean counterpart, he condemned that. But also, they would like to make sure that this Yoon Suk-yeol administration, that's been pretty much a darling to Biden administration, stays in course in terms of South Korea-U.S. relations.
And that was Jen Moon speaking to me late at night from the South Korean capital, Seoul. This is NewsHour. Coming up on the programme, as promised, we're expecting to hear from the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. He's due to start giving his press conference in about 25 minutes, and he is expected to announce his resignation. We'll bring that to you live and get some live analysis as well from Ottawa. Also, European leaders have accused the US-based billionaire Elon Musk of using his social media platform X to interfere in the continent's politics. We'll hear about an extraordinary multi-pronged row that's going on right now with Elon Musk in Britain. And one other headline. President Biden has announced a ban on new drilling in most US coastal waters 2 weeks before President Trump takes office. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC in London with me, Tim Franks. How do you save a species? Portugal and Spain faced that dilemma after the numbers of the Iberian lynx dropped dangerously low to only 94 specimens in 2003. But a coordinated programme for breeding in captivity has brought those numbers to more than 2,000 lynxes in the wild across both countries. And this year, its endangered status was lowered to just vulnerable. Antonio Fernandes reports from southern Portugal.
Navarro, a male lynx, calls a female during mating season. His chances of success are now not that bad.
The Iberian lynx was very, very close to extinction. We're talking about just 25 females in reproductive age across two populations that didn't interact. We only had four animals in captivity back then. The only feline species that was threatened at this level was the saber-toothed tiger thousands of years ago.
That's Rodrigo Serra, who coordinates the program for reproduction in captivity across the peninsula. He explains the 1950s saw changes in the use of land for agriculture and brought with it efforts to protect cattle from predators. People were even paid to hunt them, he says. As more roads were built, runovers spiked. Then, from the 1980s, two pandemics led to a fall of 95% in the numbers of wild rabbits, which are key in the species' food chain. The Portuguese center, down in the Algarve, is fairly remote, and as the animals hide away in their pens, it feels incredibly quiet. We are whispering because even though we are some 200 meters away, our presence is stressing the animals. Rodrigo says sometimes that's exactly what they need.
When we notice a litter is becoming a bit more confident or getting closer to the keeper when he's in the central corridor, we go in and chase them and make noise so that they are scared again and climb the fences. We're training them not to get close to people in the wild.
Lynxes are moved across the reproduction centers depending on the needs. And when the time comes, genetics too determine where they are released to diminish chances of inbreeding or disease. Alcoutín, on the border with Spain, is one of the places where lynxes are released. Pedro Sarmento, who has studied them for 30 years, waits by a main road, the kind that kills lynxes often.
Unlike most felines, the lynx has a short tail, has brushes in the ears and a long beard. As a biologist, there are two things that strike me when I'm handling a lynx. It's an animal with a fairly small head for its body and extraordinarily wide paws. That gives them an impulsion and ability to jump, which are rare.
These sounds of a mum calling her cubs have been captured by the camera traps set to track lynxes and their behavior. Looking through the footage, we can see some were here just this morning. Reintroduction is not something that happens overnight. The first efforts started back in Spain in 1992. Now there's hope that by 2035, the species will reach a favorable conservation status. Biologist Pedro Sarmento, again.
I saw the species disappearing. It's surreal that we're in a place where we can see lynx through camera trapping almost daily. We won't relax, but it looks clear that the reintroduction will reach all goals and the species will be saved.
The words of the biologist Pedro Sarmento ending that report from Antonio Fernandes. There seems to be some significant movements across front lines in the war between Russia and Ukraine. Today, the Russian military has claimed to have captured a key town in eastern Ukraine, the logistically important Kurukhov, while the Ukrainians have launched their own surprise new offensive inside Russia's Kursk region. Professor Michael Clark is a fellow of King's College London and the former Director General of the Royal United Services Institute.
The Russians are still pushing down in the south, particularly pushing towards Chasiv Yar and Pokrovsk, and there's no diminution in that. Those offensives, they're very slow, they're very painstaking, they're taking enormous losses, but they're still going steadily forward, albeit by a half a kilometre a day or something like that. And the Ukrainians have launched some local counterattacks, but they're not able to prevent this gradual Russian consolidation of more territory down in the south. But in the Ukraine pocket, this is the part of Kursk that the Ukrainians invaded on the 7th of August, the Ukrainians have held on to about 60% of that little pocket that they took from the Kursk region, and they're now pushing against some of the Russian counterattacks. And so within that pocket, the Russians are pushing in the northwest of the pocket, and the Ukrainians are holding them there generally, but now the Ukrainians are pushing themselves in the southeast of that pocket. They're pushing out of Sudza, which is the main town in the area, which they hold and they've held since August, and they look as if they're pushing to try to recapture Berdin. They've pushed on at least three fronts, and some of them, at least one of those fronts might be a diversion, but it looks as if they're pushing to the northeast of Sudza and directly east of Sudza with some quite significant units which look as if they've been quite well coordinated. The information that I have is that they have committed their 95th Air Assault Brigade, certainly part of it, which is their premier brigade, is Western trained, Western equipped. And if the 95th is there, then it shows that the Ukrainians mean it, that they intend to achieve some local success, at least in the next day or so.
So the Ukrainians, using the what you've said is a really sort of prized brigade in this renewed offensive in Kursk, beyond the desire, obviously, to cause Russia as much pain as possible, what do you think is the strategic objective for Ukraine?
They want to embarrass the Russians, and they've done that again, because Putin wanted this Kursk incursion to be blotted out, completely snuffed out by the end of October, and it just hasn't happened. So the fact that this incursion goes on is an embarrassment. It's more of an embarrassment because the Russians have even now got 10, 11,000 North Korean troops fighting for Russian territory in Kursk. That's pretty embarrassing too. So the Ukrainians are adding to all that embarrassment. I mean, not by a huge amount, but they're showing the Russians and the Americans that they can still fight, that they're not automatically withdrawing on all fronts, and that they can cause the Russians some pain and some problems, and that they shouldn't be written off as a military organization. And they're showing themselves, their own public, that they shouldn't be too depressed about this. And I think that's part of the idea behind this. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there aren't two or three other things about to happen in the next week or so. I mean, some of us have been anticipating some sort of surprise Ukrainian move between now and the end of January in order to achieve these sorts of objectives. And this may not be the only one. I don't know where others may occur, but I'm keeping an eye on a couple of places along the border and a couple of places in the Black Sea where the Ukrainians may feel that they can spring another surprise in order to increase both their psychological status and the potential bargaining power if they are pressed into negotiations in March or April.
And that was Professor Michael Clark from King's College London on the latest attempts to try and move the front lines in the Russia-Ukraine war. This is NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC. Welcome back to NewsHour. Elon Musk, the world's richest man and the close ally of Donald Trump, has turned his fire on a perhaps surprising new target. On Sunday, he slammed Nigel Farage, the leader of Britain's increasingly popular right-wing opposition party, Reform. Mr. Musk said that Mr. Farage needed to go, all this just days after the Reform leader had been pictured with a billionaire in Florida, with talk swirling of an enormous donation coming from Elon Musk to the Reform Party. Our political correspondent is Rob Watson. What's going on?
Previously, they seemed like they had an awful lot in common because Nigel Farage and Elon Musk both fancied themselves as being anti-woke, sort of anti an elite establishment, which they think has essentially sort of betrayed a majority of ordinary people with a sort of pushing of multiculturalism and wokery. But where they seem to have fallen out is over a man in British politics, or on the fringes of British politics, called Tommy Robinson, a far-right anti-Islam activist. And Mr. Musk has thought as just described him as a political prisoner. He's currently in prison for contempt of court. And Nigel Farage has taken the view that Tommy Robinson is just too toxic and would damage the Reform brand.
So Elon Musk thinks that Nigel Farage's past is used by date. And he's also, I guess, slightly more predictably, taken another massive swipe at the current British government.
Absolutely, and all this stuff is pretty unprecedented, really, Tim. I mean, to deal with the Farage-Musk relationship, I mean, who knows that the love affair may be on again. These are rather mercurial characters. But absolutely, here in Britain, I mean, I think nobody can remember anything quite like this. The world's richest man taking aim at the government of the day, saying essentially that it had been complicit in downplaying rape gangs of mainly Pakistan, men of Pakistani descent, raping white children. This was cases in the past. And it's just been extraordinary. And although Keir Starmer has sort of sought not to take on Mr. Musk personally for all sorts of reasons, he's come out absolutely swinging today, saying, you know, this was all a load of sort of far-right nonsense, a politics based on lies, whereas we needed a politics based on truth. But of course, all of this very complicated for European politicians, not just Mr. Starmer, but others in Europe have been speaking out because, you know, they don't like what Elon Musk is doing. They think it's profoundly dangerous to him, but they don't want to upset his best mate, i.e. the incoming president, Donald Trump.
And in terms of this row, I mean, it's a very protracted story, Rob, and we don't have a huge amount of time. But, I mean, it's one of the most painful episodes, isn't it, in recent British social history?
Yes, it is, because, you know, essentially an awful lot of victims, their complaints were ignored, and the accusation was and still is that it's because, you know, the police, the state, was essentially worried about community relations because those who were suspected of these offences were of Muslim Pakistani descent. And I think it's long been acknowledged that that was the case. The row now is, you know, should there be some new kind of inquiry to deal with all of this, or has it already been done? And are those who are calling for it essentially political opportunists?
And that was our political correspondent, Rob Watson, with the latest on that row, courtesy of Elon Musk. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Tim Franks. The war in Gaza continues its bloody path. Death, hunger and cold continue to stalk the 2 million Palestinians crammed into the territory. And the agony continues in Israel for the families with hostages still being held in Gaza. It's long proved premature to talk of progress towards a ceasefire deal, but there has just been some movement, at least. On Sunday, the BBC was shown a list of 34 of those hostages whom Hamas suggested they are willing to give up in return for a ceasefire and a release of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. Among those named on the list are 10 women and 11 older male hostages, as well as young children that Hamas had previously claimed were killed in an Israeli airstrike. Rushdi Abu Alouf is the BBC's Gaza correspondent. He's currently based in Istanbul. What does he read into the latest exchange of information?
Well, I think the list isn't new. It was sent to Hamas by the mediators back in July. What is different is that Hamas decided to share this list with the BBC and some other news outlets. It's part of their, I think, strategy to put pressure on the Israeli side by publishing the names on the list. You know, two out of these lists were people were taken like hostages back in 2016. One is the Arab-Israeli and another Ethiopian, I think. What is different also, Tim, is that Hamas was rejecting releasing 11 names from this list last year when we talk about progress last year, because they claim that those are in the age of reserve soldiers between 18 and 50. What is different now is Hamas saying that they are ready to release them. The problem now is that Hamas didn't clarify whether all of them are dead or alive. But they said, we will release whoever is alive from them, and then we are ready to hand over the bodies of the rest of those who were killed. Because, you know, Hamas claimed many times during the last year that Israeli airstrikes had killed some of the names in the list, especially the two babies and their mother.
And are you getting the sense that at the moment, I mean, obviously there's lots of talk about, you know, the politics around this and the timing of Donald Trump coming into office, but are you getting the impression that there is at least some meaningful negotiation going on?
I think the main gap between Hamas and Israel is that Hamas want to end the war. They want a complete, you know, deal. Israel want only a certain period of time, and they want some of the hostages in the first stage. Hamas insists that they want to end the war. It's not necessarily in the first stage. They are willing to accept any deal two stages, three stages deal. But in the end, they want the war to be ended. And what is the gap, I understand, from the Egyptian and the Qataris, the two main mediators, is that Israel isn't willing to end the war, as they said. Okay. But Hamas insisted they want to end the war. So we might end up with a partial sort of deal, maybe a ceasefire similar to the one we had back in November 2023, a bit longer.
Gaza correspondent Rushdie Abu-Alu speaking to me from Istanbul. One of the names on this list of 34 Israeli hostages is 84-year-old Oded Lifshitz. He was abducted on the 7th of October 2023 from his kibbutz near Oz, close to the border with Gaza, along with his wife Yocheved. She was released after 16 days. Oded remains in captivity after more than 450 days. Their daughter Sharon came into the NewsHour studio a little earlier today.
I think I always try to dampen my enthusiasm because the chances of my father are slim. He was frail 458 days ago and the conditions in Gaza are horrendous. I also thought my mom did not survive and then she just emerged from the ground. So I hold hope, but you know, there is a movement that we are part of. We are like a body of 100 families pushing for the release of our loved ones. Our vast majority wants to finish the war, to see all of them back. It's very hard to see a list knowing all the people from my community that are not on the list, all the people who I met through the last 500 and so days, that their loved ones are not on the list. So I see people whose loved one returned, all of them, and they continue to fight for the most part because it's impossible to imagine a world in which some of them are still there and us moving on.
Your father, he's 84 now, is yeah. that right? Have you had any news since your mother was released after 16 days of captivity as to the status of your father?
My father was injured on the 7th of October in his hand and in his legs. My mom thought he was dead, but when the hostages came back in the first deal in late November 23, it came true that he was alive, that he was with another woman from my kibbutz in the same room, that he was seen on the first day by another hostage that returned. So we know he was alive to begin with. We know he looked for my mom. We know he was not in a good condition, and we know his condition was deteriorating.
In terms of what needs to happen now, I mean, clearly you would say, look, a deal needs to be done right now to release all the hostages and for there to be a ceasefire in Gaza. Given you've been making this argument for so long, what pressure do you think you can put on the Israeli Prime Minister to take the final steps?
We know 70% of the population of Israel supports a ceasefire, withdrawal of Israel from Gaza, and an exchange with Palestinian prisoners, including those with blood on their hands. So the vast majority of the Israeli public is behind the idea of finishing the war against what is often being people assume here. And we are trying to do all we can to push on the incoming Trump administration. I believe that that is our biggest leverage. I know that the Qataris are back in the negotiating table. It feels that there is a real push for it. And hopefully there will be enough in it for the Prime Minister of Israel to finally, and far too late for many people who lost their life as a result, to say, yes, we will withdraw from Gaza. We will go for a final deal. On the way to that, there can be a partial deal, but only as the first stage of a final deal in which everybody come home, the war ends, Israel withdraw from Gaza.
I mean, you say a majority in Israel obviously want the release of the hostages, but there will be a large number of people in Israel who will say Hamas is still a threat and it can't be trusted. It will play with the emotions of Israelis for as long as they possibly can, as far as the hostages are concerned.
That is a fair assessment. However, two things. First, history shows us that you can't absolutely eliminate an organization that is fanatic, that is ideological. Hamas is also able to recruit now. For Israel to stay there in order to keep fighting this fraction and this fraction of Hamas actually undermines the achievement in this war. I don't agree with this war. I think we should have gone to exchange of hostages at the very beginning. My father would have been home. Many people we have buried over the last year would have been home. Our loss is so devastating. We know some of the hostages are dead. We are really needing to get them back. Hamas is a bigger problem, like Al-Qaeda is. Israel has alliances in the Middle East. We have Egypt, we have the PA. These are forces that should come in and start running Gaza. It seems that Hamas agreed to that. And the fanatics on both sides gain from the continuation of the war. The people of the Middle East, the people of the region, the people who want to have a sanity and life and believe in the sanctity of life, meaning we don't want to resettle Gaza. We are devastated by the destruction. We want a ceasefire. And absolutely, Hamas should be eliminated, but it cannot be eliminated by war.
And that was the daughter of one of the Israeli hostages, Sharon Lifshitz. The new authorities in Syria have promised justice for the crimes committed under the Assad regime and warned members of the public not to try to take matters into their own hands. But is the justice system, which was an instrument of repression, capable of being reconfigured to take on this immense moral and logistical challenge? Sebastian Usher has this report from Damascus.
On the edge of Douma, one of the Damascus suburbs most devastated by the war, Mazen retraces the 12-year Calvary in which she desperately sought news of two of her sons swallowed up in the Assad-era security system. For Mazen, she finally received a death certificate, but for Abdul Hadi, no trace of him has ever been revealed. Her third son, Ahmed, also spent 3 years in Assad's jails, his front teeth stoved in by a torturer's hammer. He remembers one moment when he believes he heard Mazen's voice for an instant, answering a roll call in the same jail, but nothing more. What justice does Mazen seek for the near destruction of her family?
It should be divine justice coming from God. He should be tortured exactly the same way he tortured young men, not just my children. My two children died, or have probably died. May God have mercy on them. But there are thousands of other young men who were subjected to torture.
My name is Hassan Issa. I am a lawyer in Damascus.
One of those who sought justice for those accused of political crimes under the Assads is the lawyer Hussein Issa. He believes that many of the judges who were complicit with the Assad regime should be kicked out and legal action taken against them. As for the huge challenge of trying to deliver retrospective justice for the horrors of the past 50 years, Hussein Issa says that establishing a judiciary capable of this is the most important task for Syria's new authorities.
The judicial system should be the most important thing in the new regime. Any complaints, any rights transgressed, should be dealt with by the judicial system. If this system isn't good, then the future of the new state will be grim. However, since I'm optimistic, I think the new regime will definitely be better.
High up here on the mountain above Damascus, Syrians young and old are breathing free, literally intoxicated by the cold, clear winter air in a place that they were barred from for more than a decade. Yet another indignity from the Assad years for which they want justice. Across the country, Syrians are trying to hold the new authorities to their promises of freedom, accountability, and genuine justice. It's a fragile moment, poised like a choir of young women singing in the courtyard of one of the great Ottoman houses of Damascus, between the oppressive past and an uncertain future.
That report from Damascus from Sebastian Usher. Just to say, I am gazing as I speak to you at a feed from one of the news agencies of the outside of Rideau Cottage, which is the home of Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, and that's because he's due to announce his resignation very shortly. We'll be across it here on NewsHour. This is NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC in London. I'm Tim Franks. And Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, is late, I can assure you. We were told that he was due to give a press conference 6 minutes ago, at which he is widely expected to announce that he's stepping down as leader of his party and Prime Minister of the country. He is 6 minutes late, but we are keeping up a live feed from the television news agencies outside his residence, Rideau Cottage, and we'll bring that to you as soon as we get him coming down the icy steps. But let's go now to Stephen Chase. He's political reporter for the Globe and Mail newspaper, and he's in the capital, Ottawa. Stephen, just for our listeners around the world, remind us why it has gone so badly wrong for Justin Trudeau.
I would say the cost of living in Canada, inflation, we had housing prices have soared in the last few years. We have had immigration mess. We've had food prices have soared. And of course, he's been in power nearly 9 years, which leaders tend to go stale by that point. So a combination of factors, and of course, we're now facing an existential threat from the United States with Mr. Trump, the president-elect, threatening tariffs of 25% on all Canadian goods.
Yeah, and with, 80% of exports going to the US from Canada. I mean, one of the striking things about this episode has been, you imagine that, yes, of course, the shine goes off leaders and things go wrong and people starting to get tired. He's had some of the most scathing remarks have come from his own party, from his own senior ministers.
Mr. Trudeau led the Liberals out of the political wilderness. They were the third party. And he brought them to power unexpectedly in the 2015 election, and so many of these people owe their political careers to him. And when people start to realize that, with the Liberal Party at 21% in the polls, 14% in the polls, depending on when you see the poll taken, their ticket to ride is gone. And so they are facing political oblivion as a party, relegated to perhaps 35 seats, which is a pittance in the House. And so that they need him to go. I think it's far too late, though. It should have happened at least a year ago.
Mm. And in terms of who is likely to take over now, I mean, as you pointed out, the Liberal Party have cratered, and a huge number of people in the country, if the opinion polls are to be believed, think that the country is going in the wrong direction. Who is going to profit from that politically?
Well, the opposition leader, the official leader of the opposition, Pierre Poilievre, is the leader of the Conservative Party. His party is about 46% in the polls these days. The next election is his to lose. But in the meantime, of course, with Mr. Trudeau's resignation today, as we expect, there will be a Liberal leadership race, and there could be a new face in Rideau Cottage in the next few weeks or months.
Right. Okay. So is it not a given that elections will happen immediately in that case?
It's not a given, no. In fact, we expect that there's a series of events that will take place. Mr. Trudeau is expected to announce that he's prorogued the House, meaning dissolve, essentially suspended Parliament until March. And then, of course, we're expecting there will be a Liberal leadership race, an open race, and that will be a very truncated race, very short time period, possibly, to finish by March or April, and a new Liberal leader in place, which means effectively a new Prime Minister in the short term. But of course, at some point this year, the Liberals have to go to the polls, at least by convention, and they will definitely face a defeat.
Stephen Chase, political reporter from the Globe and Mail, speaking to us live from Ottawa. Thank you very much indeed. And still waiting to see Justin Trudeau turn up. So let me take you now, in that case, to New York, because congestion pricing arrived in the city on Sunday, and it meant today has been its first rush hour morning with a daily fee of up to $9 for cars driving into at least part of Manhattan. The scheme's intended to raise billions for the city's public transport network to ease traffic flow and to improve air quality. New York's the first place in the US to have the system, but it has been used for several other cities around the world. John McDonough has been driving a cab in the city for more than 40 years.
To me, it's a complete disaster. And the way the politicians are lying to us, you know, claiming this name is called congestion pricing, which was probably thought up by some focus group. It will have nothing to do with congestion in Manhattan. What's wrong with going on in Manhattan with the traffic is the street design. Because now we have bus lanes on one side, we have bike lanes on the other side, we got concrete barriers up. So we're confined into one lane wherever we're going. So there's constant traffic. So they create the problem, and then they say, well, the solution to that problem is now we're going to charge you $9 to come in. And it'll have no effect on congestion. It's just a tax on the working class in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx. That's all it is.
Yeah, I mean, you say it will have no effect on congestion. I guess, you know, we have seen it in operation in other cities around the world, London, for example. Traffic flow is a bit easier in London as a result of it.
Yeah, but that's not going to happen in Manhattan, because people in this part of Manhattan, they don't fix anything, say like air conditioners and boilers and everything. And it's been reported today they've gotten notices, all the buildings below 60th Street, that if you need something fixed, that the company that's coming in to do it is going to add on $50. So everybody's being affected, whether you drive a car or not, and you live below 60th Street, you're going to be affected and you're going to pay for this. I mean, we have a governor here who flies around on a private jet. She's already spent over $500,000 flying all around, and she's telling us that we have to pay $9 to go into Manhattan.
But, I mean, that will be a cost that presumably you will pass on to your passengers. And in terms of how much extra the passenger will have to pay per journey, I mean, it's not going to be very much, is it?
Yeah, but this is added on to all the other taxes. There's a wheelchair tax. There are so many taxes, you can barely fit it onto the meter at the moment. And allegedly, all of this is going to make the subway better. And I don't know if you've been reading the papers here. Our subways are a disaster. We just had a homeless woman burned to death. People are being pushed in front of the subway. People are being robbed. That has no effect. And we have fare beaters here. The subway system is losing over $700 million a year with people not paying the fare on the subway or the buses. And they claim that is what's going to be the intake of people coming into Manhattan in cars. So what they're doing is offsetting their fare beaters. Instead of arresting them or stopping them from jumping the turnstiles here, they're going to say, well, you know what? We're not going to do that. We're just going to pass it on to the people, the working class that are coming in from Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx.
New York cabbie John McDonough giving us his opinion. He is not impressed. And that brings this edition of NewsHour to a close. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for listening.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohamed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.